It's rare to get an invitation to visit North Korea. So when our North Asia correspondent Matthew Carney was offered a chance, he jumped at it. The ABC hasn't been there in nearly a decade. The North Koreans wanted to show off their military hardware to mark the 70th anniversary of the ruling Workers' Party, so they opened the door just a little to the foreign media. Although the trip was tightly controlled by government minders, Matthew says it's what he picked up and saw on the way that gave him the biggest insights into a country that still remains the most isolated in the world.
I never thought I would see him, but there he was, 50 metres in front of me, Kim Jong-un, the despotic young leader of North Korea that the world knows very little about. He was overseeing the military parade and pledging annihilation for the United States and South Korea. My guide said it's the closest a foreign journalist has ever got to him. The surprise for me is that Kim Jong-un looked like little boy lost. I'd heard all the stories, killing his uncle, then feeding him to dogs, executing 500 of his closest generals. But on close inspection, he looked unimpressive. Introverted, shy almost, and physically a lot bigger than what we see of him in North Korean propaganda. In fact, he looked obese as he lumbered along the veranda looking down at his troops. He had none of the charisma or stature of his grandfather, the founder of North Korea, Kim Il-sung. In the background, coming into view now and again, I could see his little sister, 28-year-old Kim Yo-jong, the Dark Princess, as some have come to call her, and it did appear as if she was directing the show, the power behind the throne. Since July, she's been in charge of the North Korean Propaganda and Agitation Department, and she's responsible for developing her brother's cult of personality, a powerful position that creates the myths that keeps the Kims in power. And upon seeing their leader, Kim Jong-un, people seem to go into an emotional state, shaking and crying. It's hard to know what to make of this. In Australia, people are more likely to hurl abuse at politicians, but here they can be executed for not clapping or crying enough. North Korea is a fascinating place. It's the last bastion of Stalinistic-inspired communism still functioning, and the state controls the message. Outside broadcasts like the BBC are jammed. No satellite TV is allowed, and definitely no internet. The hotel where I was staying, the Yanggado, is a case in point. Officially, floor 3 does not exist. The elevator went from 2 to 4, but no floor 3. So taking my washing bag as a cover, I went in search of it and found an indiscreet stairway that led up to it. The floor was dark and the rooms were filled with government cadres, chain-smoking and monitoring foreigners with ancient listening devices. It looked like fantasy, Soviet film noir. When a cadre spotted me and demanded to know what I was doing, I pointed to my clothes bag and made a quick exit. I was lucky enough to visit North Korea 20 years ago, and in the capital, Pyongyang, not much has really changed. There's more money in town, and this time I saw luxury cars, BMWs and Land Rovers, and more consumer goods. And yes, the people did look better off. But in 20 years, the extent of change is small. Pyongyang certainly hasn't had the transformative changes that other cities in the world have undergone. And this time, like my last visit, we were only allowed to visit Pyongyang and not allowed to see the fate of the vast majority of people in the countryside. Many of them still suffer from food shortages and till the land with their hands. Instead, we were shown lifestyles of the rich and famous, how the elites of the regime live in Pyongyang. Their loyalty is rewarded with new apartments and trips to water parks or aquariums. Kim Jong-un is busy propping them up, along with his regime, while most famish. On my last night, I was told a casino existed in a hidden underground floor of the hotel where I was staying. I was determined to find it, and after going down several nondescript stairwells, I found the right one, and another world opened up. It was a huge floor with rows of poker machines, roulette, blackjack tables, impressive by any standards. And the majority of customers were Chinese, with piles of chips ready to spend, and looking on, North Korean cadres drinking whiskey. In many ways, this to me was modern-day North Korea, the regime's elite chasing hard currency, because the money is the key to keeping them and the regime afloat. This is Matthew Carney reporting in Pyongyang, North Korea, for Correspondence Report.
When two young men were found beheaded in a southern Turkish city on Saturday, news spread quickly through the Syrian activist network. They'd both been activists from the city of Raqqa, the Islamic State group's de facto capital in Syria, and they'd been devoted to speaking out against the extremists. News of their deaths hit our Middle East correspondent Matt Brown hard.
It was one of those moments all too rare in the Middle East. I felt happy after an interview. The people I'd been dealing with, I assumed, were no angels, but they were brave, and they weren't carrying guns. Yep, after the best part of 10 years in the region, that's where I'm at. They were activists from a tiny little group called Raqqa is being slaughtered silently. Most of their friends are in Raqqa, the Islamic State stronghold in eastern Syria. They post pictures and videos online, revealing Islamic State abuses, defying their rule, or sometimes just showing the dusty, normal streets of the so-called caliphate. The people I'd been speaking to had to flee Raqqa after death threats from IS last year. Muhammad Al-Salah met me first at my hotel. He wanted to check us out. Then he showed me a picture of his front door in Turkey posted on Facebook. Nothing too dramatic about that, except that it was posted by someone identifying as an IS supporter. And now I've found out how real it was. As I drove around Istanbul doing interviews in advance of this weekend's elections, my phone lit up with a grisly message. A member of the group and his friend had been beheaded in southern Turkey. They were no one I'd spoken to, and they were in a different city. But an IS supporter was already online praising the killings, and it was a chilling reminder of their reach. I haven't been able to get in touch with Muhammad, and I'm guessing he's in shock. But he and his colleagues had also told me they're determined to keep going no matter what. One founder's father had already been murdered by IS, and the extremist sent Muhammad photos of his brother's mutilated corpse after he was killed in a shootout in the company of a more moderate rebel group. In fact, by the time Muhammad fled Raqqa, he'd been locked up and released by IS, two other extremist groups, and the Syrian government, tracking the horrible arc of this civil war. You'd forgive all of them if they gave it all up now. But next time you hear about Syria, about victims and villains, and it all seems like it's on a different planet, please remember these people speaking out against tyranny and terrorism, and sometimes paying with their lives to do so. As I say, I'd never met the two dead young men, but this weekend their killers stole something from me. And they stole something from you too. This is Matt Brown in Istanbul for Correspondence Report.
At the other end of the spectrum, our Africa correspondent Martin Cudahy also saw something this week that he'll never forget. A little girl being given the gift of sight. Here's Martin.
Faith Semiyan is sitting on the ground outside her home, a mud hut on a small farm in western Kenya. She's playing a game with the other village children. They are taking small seeds out of a container and throwing them into the air. But there is a big difference between them. When the seed falls, Faith uses her hands to feel for where it has dropped. The other children watch it fall and pick it up with their deft little fingers. Oh. Faith Semiyan is blind and has been since birth. It's bilateral cataracts, so that means she can probably see a little. It's hard to tell, but maybe shadows or shapes. At one point during the afternoon, she appears to be staring directly into the sun. Perhaps what's blinding light to you and me is allowing her to see just a little. Members of the Fred Hollows Foundation have made the trip to Western Kenya to help Faith. The three-year-old and her auntie are going to be taken further than any of them have travelled before, to an eye hospital near the town of Kisumu, on the banks of Lake Victoria. It's here that Faith has her eyesight restored. It's a relatively short procedure, about 40 minutes or so, and then a 24-hour wait to see the outcome. In journalism, you sometimes get to witness the worst side of human nature. In Africa, that's conflict, famine, and terrorism. But there are moments of light that balance out the job. It's just lovely being able to witness a three-year-old girl gaining sight. I have a son the same age. Once she realises the change, Faith starts talking excitedly. "Mama, I can see you." And then she says, "If I get a pen, I will go to school." At 3 years old, she already knows the value of an education. I sometimes think that lesson has been lost in the broth of Australia's relative affluence. I'm watching and smiling, and in my pocket are two pens. I take one out. It's from a hotel, a dark colour with silver writing. A cheap pen from a cheap bedside table somewhere, a ubiquitous object in the life of a correspondent. I pass it to Faith. She cradles the pen and holds it close to her eyes. They are still adjusting to the light. One of the first objects she sees post-surgery is a pen I have given her. It is the very least I can do. Not many people get to see something so profound. When the nurse removes the patches from Faith's eyes, she was confused at first, and tears began to fall. I saw most of it through the lens of a camera. Perhaps because it was work, or perhaps the viewfinder offers a degree of detachment, but the emotional impact of what I was filming passed me by at the time. When I watched the footage later, it was different. The change that had been brought about for this girl was so much more obvious. No longer would she have to be carried everywhere. No longer would her aunt have to hold her hand to walk and to eat and to wash. That now should be a thing of the past. For she can see, and I got to see her seeing. From Nairobi, this is Martin Carahy for Correspondence Report.
The US presidential race started off strangely, to say the least, and it's pretty much stayed that way. It's been marked by the stunning success of the so-called outsiders, in particular Donald Trump. Every time he opens his mouth, it seems, someone, somewhere, is insulted, and yet his popularity only seems to increase. Our North America correspondent Ben Knight has been watching on.
I can remember the moment when I thought, well, that's it. This is where it ends for Donald Trump. It was last month in the second Republican candidates debate, and the Donald's bluster was suddenly looking and sounding very tired. And for the first time, one of his opponents had landed a blow. In the lead-up to the debate, Carly Fiorina had been the target of a typical Donald Trump stink bomb.
Last week in Rolling Stone magazine, Donald Trump said the following about you, quote, "Look at that face. Would anyone vote for that? Can you imagine that? The face of our next president." Mr. Trump later said he was talking about your persona, not your appearance. Please feel free to respond what you think about his persona.
You know, it's interesting to me. Mr. Trump said that he heard Mr. Bush very clearly and what Mr. Bush said. I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said.
Donald Trump looked chastened for the first time in this campaign, even if he didn't sound it.
I think she's got a beautiful face, and I think she's a beautiful woman.
Donald Trump's outrage machine has only rolled on since that moment, seemingly unstoppable. It's almost as though the American voting public is incapable of being outraged anymore. One after another, the Donald has dropped Trumpisms that have shocked the pundits and the press.
In your speech today, you said that, quote, some rapists are coming across the border with Mexico.
Absolutely.
What did you mean by that?
We have drug dealers coming across. We have rapists. We have killers. We have murderers. Why, do you think they're going to send us? I mean, it's common sense. You think they're going to send us their best people and their finest people?
In a previous era, when the media was still the gatekeepers of information and opinion, Donald Trump's comments might indeed have ended his campaign. But this is 2015, and it doesn't work that way anymore. The Trump phenomenon might be considered unique, the kind of campaign that only Donald Trump could pull off. As a reality TV star, he doesn't need to spend money getting himself into the media. And as a billionaire, he doesn't have to answer to donors for any missteps and gaffes he makes on the campaign trail. And because he never has to apologise for the kind of statements that would sink an old-style campaign, Donald Trump carries the mantle of the straight-talking outsider, and he reaps the support in the polls, which then perpetuates the phenomenon. But in fact, the Trump phenomenon is not unique. This past week, he found himself battling for top position in the opinion polls with another straight-talking outrage machine, Dr. Ben Carson.
You know, Obamacare is really, I think, the worst thing that has happened in this nation since slavery.
Like Donald Trump, Ben Carson does not backtrack and he does not apologise. He's compared abortion and Obamacare to slavery. And he said that he would not accept a Muslim as President of the United States.
I would not advocate that we put a Muslim in charge of this nation. I absolutely would not agree with that.
Ben Carson dismisses his critics as agents of political correctness, who are only hearing the references to Nazis and slavery and missing the deeper point of what he's saying. The problem for Ben Carson is the deeper point really isn't there. He makes a habit of comparing things to Nazism and slavery, which, for a neurosurgeon and someone of obvious high intelligence, is hardly evidence of deep thinking. In fact, Ben Carson gets facts flat wrong. And when he's called out on it, he insists that he's right. Like this exchange with ABC America's George Stephanopoulos, who pushed Ben Carson on his claim that if the US had become energy independent, Saudi Arabia would have been so worried they would have handed over Osama bin Laden to the Americans within 2 weeks of the 9/11 attacks.
Well, I think they would have been extremely concerned if we had declared, and we were serious about it, that we were going to become petroleum independent, because it would have had a major impact on their finances. And I think that probably would have trumped any loyalty that they had to people like Osama bin Laden.
But they didn't have any loyalty to Osama bin Laden. The Saudis kicked him out. He was their enemy.
Well, you may not think that they had any loyalty to him, but I believe otherwise.
Of course, candidates have used controversy and racism to grab attention before. And while the polls do have Donald Trump and Ben Carson at the top, the bookies don't. Their favourites are the more traditional establishment candidates, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, although Jeb Bush's stocks have fallen this week. But what has been fascinating to watch is just what the American public is prepared to hear and accept as part of the public discourse, especially when compared to, say, the outpouring of rage they expressed over the killing of Cecil the Lion by a Minnesota dentist on a hunting trip in Zimbabwe. Much of that outrage was vented on the internet, and that is where Donald Trump and Ben Carson's supporters can be found too. Ben Carson's Facebook page has more than 4 million followers. That's more than any other presidential campaign. Donald Trump, meanwhile, continues to find the lines in public debate that are rarely crossed and then take a running jump at them. He stunned Republicans when he held George W. Bush responsible for the 9/11 attacks. It completely blindsided his brother Jeb Bush, who floundered for a response to a question that is simply not raised in polite Republican circles. Now, Donald Trump is going after his main challenger, Ben Carson, by crossing another red line in American politics, ridiculing his Seventh-day Adventist faith.
I'm Presbyterian. That's down the middle of the road, folks, in all fairness. I mean, Seventh-day Adventist, I don't know about. I just don't know about.
I'll say it here. Neither Donald Trump nor Ben Carson are electable as president. The Republican primary is not a general election. But this is no ordinary Republican primary. And when the time comes for the main game, It will be fascinating to see what the other candidates' strategists have learned from it. This has been Knight in Washington for Correspondents Report.